try sometimes. Well, you might find.
Welcome to Visionaries. I'm John LaBelle, your host. Wow, our first show. So, on Visionaries, we're going to talk about creativity in the arts, sciences, technology, culture, spirituality, and about how we can enrich the world and ourselves by tapping into the energies of the cosmos. So look for us here on Progressive Radio Network, that's PRNFM, on Mondays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, and you can find our back shows, as soon as we have some, on the PRN archives. And along the way, we'll talk to some of the most interesting visionaries about the world we live in and the worlds they're creating for tomorrow. Usually we'll have a guest, but today I'm going to talk about the idea of the show, about visionary creativity. I attend all kinds of conferences. Mostly futurist technology, and all around the country. Unfortunately, a lot of them are in California. I'm in New York, so I have to hit my school up for budget. But I encounter really interesting people, and I'm professor of architecture at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, New York. So I have quite a few colleagues who we're going to hear on this show as well, who I think are quite interesting people. It's interesting saying that I teach in Brooklyn, which is now the cool cultural capital of the world. That wasn't the case 40 years ago when I started teaching there. But we have some really interesting stuff going on in Brooklyn at a Pratt Institute. So I'm going to try to bring you some really original thinkers here on Visionaries. And we'll have call-ins for our interviews. And today, I want to focus a bit on the idea of what is a visionary. And it just so happens that I wrote a book about that. It's called Visionary Creativity, How New Worlds Are Born. So I'll just read a little bit from the cover. Visionary creatives swim in the culture of our day. The things they create in art, design, science, technology, business, embody our culture and at the same time pull us into the future. So we begin with the notion that worlds are created. You know, we'd say, well, who are we and what world do we live in? And I teach a course in architecture, in non-Western architecture. And so we, you know, look at various cultures around the world and look at their architecture. And I begin the course by giving my students a questionnaire. And the very question is, who are we and what world do we live in? And, you know, we're a college, you know, we're supposed to be intellectuals. And so I begin with, well, aren't we biological creatures who arrive to whom and what we are through the processes of natural selection and evolution, living in a physical world governed by the laws of science. And that's sort of, you know, I guess what we're told in college, certainly in our science courses. And then I ask my students, how many people believe that? And typically, no hands go up. So that's really interesting. You know, like what's going on? We've been in the rational scientific enlightenment for 200 years. It's been promoting this idea of our materialist world. But are we really embedded in, have a sense of who and what we are? So I give my students a questionnaire, and I say, you know, next week, bring in your responses to this. And I give them about six choices, and they can pick more than one, just in case you're worried. So first one is, the world and we were created by a creator for a purpose that eludes us or to glorify that creator. We are to obey the instructions of that creator, which may be provided in a book that was revealed, And the social unit's prime responsibility is to see to it that the instructions are followed. Now, I don't label these, but let's do it right now. That's the biblical traditions, right? Judaism, Christianity, Islam, in their fundamentalist aspects, that's the belief system. Interestingly, I get about a quarter of my students choose that one. They choose another one as well, but it's, you know, it's typically, well, I was raised Catholic, but I'm getting over it, would be the response. But they, you know, a lot of people haven't let go of that point of view. Second choice is the world is made up of matter, energy, and the laws of nature. There's nothing else. Humans came about through matter governed by scientific laws and a series of mostly random accidents. Consciousness is merely the firing of neurons. So we look at today's, pardon the word, atheists, and they're in big battles with fundamentalist Christians. We have books like the God Delusion. We have Daniel Dennett. We have these major philosophical figures writing these books, arguing about the delusion of religious points of view. And then if you say to them, well, you know, I'm aware of something going on in my mind. You know, I have consciousness. I have awareness. And they say, no, that's just an illusion. All there is the firing of neurons that give you the illusion that you have consciousness. Okay, they, you know, they might be able to make a case there. So we'll call that one materialism. And then the third choice I give them is the world has always been and will not end. Our individual consciousness is a partaking in an eternal component of that world. So, you know, in the future we'll do call-ins and we'll be in dialogue here on this show. But right now, for our audience, which one is that? And of course, that would be Buddhism and other modes of Eastern thought, where the notion really is that fundamental reality, the component of fundamental reality, is the sum consciousness of all sentient beings. So there's this kind of continuity and an eternity. And number four, human beings are natural creatures. The natural world is imbued with spirit. Therefore, human, nature, and the spiritual are one unified whole. So again, who can guess? And I make a point of not labeling these for my students so that they can just sort of deal with the ideas and not prejudices about them. But we might describe that as Taoism, as you know, Lao Tzu, the Tao Te Ching, and Taoism, you might be aware, is spelled Tao with like D, D-A-O, but spelled with a T, T-A-O. And the great work is the Tao Te Ching by the legendary figure Lao Tzu. And it sees all is one continuity of flow. And our job then is to put ourselves in harmony with that flow. The fifth one I give them is human beings are the central most important thing. The purpose of a person's life is to discover and fulfill their potential. So that one is humanism. It comes about with the Enlightenment in Europe in the early mid 1700s. We see it manifest in the American Declaration of Independence and Constitution. And it's a notion that puts this value on individual human beings. And in its best sense, not in a selfish way, but your purpose in your life is to discover your potential and fully manifest it. And we attempt to create a society and institutions to help each individual do that. And the sixth one, the universe is harmonious and balanced. Humans are a disruption. We should disrupt as little as possible. So guesses on that. Which one's that? And of course, that's an ecological point of view. And if you, I like to discuss with my students the idea that if you believe that those redwood trees should be preserved because they are enriching to people, they're resources for the future, they provide recreation, then you're a humanist and an ecologist. If you believe that, or an environmentalist, if you believe that those redwood trees should be preserved because they have a moral right to exist equal to ours, then you're a deep ecologist. So these are ideas you've probably heard on lots of shows on PRN and we'll be exploring on this show. But we start with the notion that, well, who are we and what's this world we're living in? And the answer is it's up for grabs. There are a lot of points of view about that, and there may be even evolving. So my definition of a visionary creative is someone who actually creates these worldviews, changes the world, changes our notion of and experience of the world. So that's our aim in this show, to talk about that kind of approach to the world and to look at the people, and we can think right away of great artists. If we think, for example, let's just pick a big one. So think of the Viennese Symphony of Mozart and Haydn, and Beethoven begins his career in that tradition, writing those kinds of symphonies, and then eventually with the Third Symphony, and most famously with the Fifth and then the Ninth, launches what we call Romanticism and remakes himself as romantic hero. And Romanticism is defined by a notion that, well, it's a reaction to the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment had said that we as human beings can understand nature. We can, through scientific laws, through understanding the scientific laws, we can understand how and why the planets are going around the sun, why the apple falls if we let go of it, how gravity works, how thermodynamics work. We can then harness that and make steam engines and eventually understand human beings through psychology, sociology. And Romanticism says, oh yeah, you think your science can understand the depths of the human psyche and the ultimate powers and terrifying and enriching qualities of nature. So here's a totally new worldview launched by the romantic poets, artists, musicians. And they changed the world. People are now suddenly living in a totally different world. That's visionary creative. And so what I do in my book is look at that notion, try to put it forward, and then at the same time, see how we might do that for our emerging future. So that's our show, and that's the kind of guests we're going to hope to have. And so some of those guests, what are we going to do on this show? And so today's our first show. We're going to talk about visionary creativity. But some of our upcoming guests next week, September 19th, we're going to have on Bob Walter, president of the Joseph Campbell Foundation. So I'm a big fan of Joseph Campbell, and I've been involved with the foundation that was set up to manage his literary estate. So Campbell is the term that he used was mythologist, but he really he was a culturalist. He engaged everything. So his books and his lectures address not only mythology and religion, but art, architecture, culture in general. And his book that made him famous, 1949, was Hero with a Thousand Faces. And in that book, he describes what today we call the hero journey. And in the hero journey, our hero, doesn't know they're a hero, is living in ordinary reality. And something happens. There's an inciting incident. And they cross a threshold to a realm of fabulous forces where they encounter challenges, they have helpers, and they win a decisive victory and enrich the world, often come into resolution with their father figure, and then return to enrich the world. So, okay, those of you who know about this, can already anticipate our next question. But what does that remind us of? And so Campbell's point is that's every fairy tale, that's Buddha, Christ, Mohammed, that Moses, that's Jack and the Beanstalk. So Jack's in ordinary reality, living in poverty with his mother, and he acquires the magic beans, and the stalk grows up to the sky. He climbs up. We're not in ordinary reality. Well, what's the term? We're not in Kansas anymore, as Dorothy puts it. And now he's in a realm of fabulous forces. Well, what's the famous recent that every film student, can recite in their sleep? And of course, it's Star Wars. So Luke Skywalker is on the farm in ordinary reality. The hologram comes, Obi-Wan, help me. He travels at a threshold, which is the bar with the weird creatures, off to a realm of fabulous forces, space technology, and he destroys the Death Star and dealing with Darth Vader, who's Darth Vader, and of course Darth Vader is his father, comes to a resolution with his father and enriches the world. And it's interesting how deeply that becomes a part of our mythology, and it's now picked up again that Disney is relaunching the Star Wars series, and can rejoin Star Trek as being a mythological setting for ourselves today. Well, Joseph Campbell wrote a lot more than that. He wrote a four-volume monster set of books called Masks of God, four volumes, Primitive Mythology, Oriental Mythology, Occidental Mythology, and Creative Mythology. Aha. So Campbell's very influential on me. I read his books, attended his lectures, wrote a book about him, was one of the 12 people he chose for the foundation that managed his literary estate. And we're going to talk next week with, again, Bob Walter, president of the Joseph Campbell Foundation. So if you want to get warmed up, one of the most accessible accesses to Campbell is through Bill Moyer's interviews with him on PBS television, and the tapes of those are readily available. Future guests, we don't have the dates pinned down yet, but we're going to interview people like Natasha Vita Moore, who is an advocate for radical life extension and human enhancement. So there's this thing called, and we'll be talking about it a bit on our shows, transhumanism. And it's a vague term. I mean, we're not even sure what humanism is. So, a term like transhumanism is going to be a bit vague. But so we start with distinguishing two things, human and humanism. And humans is human beings. They're a biological creature identified, as a species, and we can pin down their DNA. And humanism is a cultural movement that is associated with ancient Greece, with the Enlightenment, and with modernism, a notion that human beings are the central, most important thing, but also that we can use our human facilities, our observation and our rationality to engage with, understand, comprehend, and even change the world, called technology, or science and technology. So transhumanism is a notion that that human being that we've understood forever, and, you know, human Homo sapiens, us, emerge about 100,000 years ago. So if somebody had gotten successfully frozen 100,000 years ago and was thought out today young enough to go to school, they would be just like us. You know, language, rationality, they're us. But for the first time, maybe that's starting to change. What happens when you put chips in your brain? What happens when, you know, today already paralyzed people can manipulate first typewriter keyboards with their eyes, but now just by thinking? And so with these extensions of ourselves, and, you know, what happens when we, if we achieve radical life extension, and we can genetically turn off the causes of aging, and you live to 200, 300, 400, 500 years. You, through biological manipulation, through interconnection with technology, become a different creature. So that's transhumanism. Natasha Vita Moore is one of the major spokespeople for the field. She's a professor at the University of Advancing Technology and chair of the transhumanist organization, Humanity Plus. Now, everybody who's listening now, many people who are listening to me at this very moment are on a computer. So let's hope that, you know, jump ahead. The moment you hear me say Natasha Vita Moore, V-I-T-A hyphen M-O-R-E, type it into Google. Go to our website. We can do that while we're listening to this show. We'll talk in an upcoming show to Phil Cousineau, and back to my affection for Joseph Campbell and his ideas. Phil Cousineau wrote a book about Campbell, but he's gone on to lots of other things. He's an award-winning writer and filmmaker, teacher, editor, and storyteller, TV host, and we'll be looking at how we define ourselves through our stories. We'll talk to a colleague of mine, a big fan of, John David Ebert. And right now, again, if you want to follow, you can go to culturaldiscourse.com, which is Ebert's website. And Ebert and I share another website, cinemadiscourse.com, all one word. And Ebert's a cultural commentator, author of a whole bunch of books, Twilight of the Clockwork God. And what he did was he just went around and interviewed all the New Age figures, all the people who were, okay, these are the people changing thoughts. This is about 15 years ago. And that was a good way to launch his career because they all got to know him. And it's a terrific book. He did Celluloid Heroes and Mechanical Dragons on superheroes in movies. He did Dead Celebrities, Living Icons, a beautiful book about figures like James Dean and Marilyn Monroe. And what the kind of conflict between, you know, for example, the conflict between Norma Jean and Marilyn Monroe, you know, these of course, they're the same person, but are they? And what is the nature of their conflict? What does it do to somebody to become a celebrity like that? He has collected a lot of movie reviews in post-classic cinema, and he's doing a series of books right now. You'll find them all on Amazon, scene by scene. So, Apocalypse Now, scene by scene. Star Wars, scene by scene. The Shining, scene by scene. Terrific book. So if you're going to rewatch the movie, you want to read his book first. And Ebert ties these, whether it's movies or mythology, into leading cultural thinkers of the day and deep thinkers and, you know, important historical figures. It's very, very intellectual, but really enriching material. We'll be talking to Luis Arana. And Luis is a senior artificial intelligence engineer at Robots Without Borders. Again, something you can put into Google. And, you know, what is this Siri on our, you know, if you have a iPhone or the equivalent of that on your Android? These things are, you know, talking to us. And the thing about that this kind of technology is, well, it can only do this and that. Yeah, but they double in capability every year. Where's it going to be in 10 years? I mean, we're going to talk about this idea of exponential growth on various shows as we go along. But the just to give you a little story of what this doubling means, you know, maybe be a little nervous here. And I'll talk about Ray Kurzweil in a moment. But there's a famous story of an artisan makes a chessboard for a Raja in India, in the old days. And beautiful inlaid semi-precious stones, presents it to him as a gift. And the Raja says, "That's beautiful. I'll give you anything you want as a return gift." And the artisan's smart enough not to ask for the Raja's daughter in marriage. That'd get him executed real quick. But he's a wise guy. So he says, "Just give me one grain of rice for the first square on this chessboard, two for the second, four for the third, 8, 16, 32, etc." "So how much rice are we talking about?" And the Raja does, you know, "What are we talking about? Four bags of rice?" So he says, "You got it." Turns out it's 10,000 times the world's entire annual production of rice. So this doubling stuff can get out of hand really quick. And then we'll talk to Mike Silver, professor of architecture at SUNY Buffalo. And I go to Mike's studio. He's got these robots walking around carrying bricks. Mike's an architect, and we're getting to a point where we're going to have robots building buildings. I mean, you know, robots make our automobiles. There's still a few people in automobile factories, not very many. And what happens when they start building our buildings? So we'll talk about that kind of thing. And he's also interested in artificial intelligence and consciousness. So we'll go into all that. So let's just take a break here for a moment and remind you that we are on Progressive Radio Network. My name is John Lobel, launching a new program, Visionaries. This is our first show. We'll be here every Monday from 10 to 11. And remember, you can hear us on PRN FM, TuneIn website, search for PRN, Ustream channel, ustream.tv. You can download on your computer from PRN FM and iTunes, and listen on your mobile device, PRN FM, TuneIn app, or Stitcher app. So lots of ways to get to us. We'll take a break, and we'll be back talking about visionary creativity in a moment.
You're tuned to PRN. We'll keep bringing you the best in alternative voices for social and political news, the environment, health, the economy, and a whole lot more. All you have to do is keep listening. PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
South of the border, down Mexico.
I'm Johnny Mueller, host of the Expat Files, that's living in Latin America. Heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's a show where you'll learn how to work, play, do business, or retire and live the life of Riley. Yes, an amazing number of first world people like you are jumping off the stateside treadmill and voting with their feet. And surprise, surprise, they're finding there really is an American dream. But it's not in Seattle, Milwaukee, or Cleveland anymore. It's down here in Latin America. So be sure to tune in to the Expat Files to find out how you can live the good life on a measly Social Security check.
Hi. Hi, I'm Allison Rose Levy, the host of Connect the Dots. We're with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. On Connect the Dots, I connect the dots between your personal health and your total health environment with a whole group of experts, advocates, activists, and wise people that connect the dots between what goes on in our total world and how it affects health. Be with us every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time for Connect the Dots. Progressive Radio Network, we're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, you might find.
Hi, everybody. This is John LaBelle back with you for the second half of our premiere show. First time we're doing this broadcast, Visionaries on PRN.FM. So my name is John LaBelle, your host. We'll be here every Monday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 10 to 11. And remember, on all our shows on PRN, you can get to them through the archive. So if you missed the show, you can just go back and listen to old shows, or go back, you know, later that day or later in the week to listen to any given show. And we're going to have on this show really interesting people. We have a bunch of them lined up. I've just been talking about them. Today, we don't have a guest. We're going to talk about, so our show is called Visionaries. And so what do we mean by that? So that's what we'll talk about today. But in the future, we'll typically have guests. Not always. I want to talk more about creativity in the future. I want to do a show coming up shortly on, pardon my academies, but a bibliographical show. In other words, what are the key books that one might read to be plugged into our world? I mentioned Joseph Campbell earlier. I'm a big fan of Campbell. I think that there's insight, really incredible insight there. By the way, if you're interested in Campbell, it can be kind of daunting. I mean, Campbell very deliberately wrote for a popular audience as opposed to an academic audience. But it can still be a bit difficult to try to penetrate. I remember when Campbell was actually writing his books, and just to tell you how old I am, back in the old days, the bookstore was the 8th Street Bookstore on 8th Street between 5th and 6th Avenue. And I would see Campbell on the shelf, and I just didn't know where to jump in. You know, it was hard to penetrate. So two recommendations. One is called a book called Myths to Live By. And these are actually done in the late 60s. Campbell did lectures at Cooper Union, a prominent art and design school in New York City, but very famous auditorium where they have all kinds of cultural figures lecture. Very famously, Abraham Lincoln lectured there. So they have that landmark. But those lectures were put into a book. So it's a series of short essays you can read in any order, and very accessible. And then the other thing I mentioned earlier, that Bill Moyers famously interviewed Campbell for public television quite some years ago, but they are occasionally replayed on PBS, and they are readily accessible, you know, on video. You can buy on Amazon or whatever. And those are certainly highly accessible. And that series was put in, it's called The Power of Myth. And that series was made into a book. Campbell didn't contribute to the book because it came out after he died. He died right after doing those interviews, even before they were broadcast. But they were edited into a book, and again, they're very accessible. Although I should warn, there's kind of two different Joseph Campbells. One is a kind of, he's famous for saying, follow your bliss, and kind of a self-helpy thing, and is kind of an academic Campbell, you know, deep into the meanings of various mythologies. And you can sort of negotiate between the two of them. And when I do my little show on bibliographical material, the second most important figure I'll mention is Marshall McLuhan. And I think everybody has heard of McLuhan. And, you know, I sometimes try my students or my teaching faculty colleagues. And all my faculty colleagues have heard of Marshall McLuhan, but none of them have read him. So we'll talk about, you know, what you should read. And McLuhan wrote a book called Understanding Media back in the days when we actually read long books. Came out in 1964, and it blew everybody away. It was one of the key things that created the 60s. And so McLuhan became a superhero culture figure, and unfortunately died young. I mean, he was in his 70s, but he became disabled by strokes and was unable to continue his contributions. But again, a more accessible version of the book is a book called The Medium is the Massage. And that's not a typo. He's famous for the phrase, the medium is the message. But he did a book, and it's one of these, it's a graphic, you know, a graphic book. So there's pictures with captions. And all the key ideas are there, but it's incredibly easily readable. So super recommended. While we're at it, some of the other books we'll talk about when we do this show. Stephen Wolfram is an entrepreneur, computer scientist, mathematician, and he created a tool, computer program called Mathematica. And just about every scientist and mathematician uses it. It's sort of like a super graphic calculator. And more recently, he wrote a book, A New Kind of Science. And in this book, he says, Isaac Newton got it wrong. Differential equations are good for describing the orbits of planets, but that's about it. It can't describe a tree or a cloud. And if you look at a tree, is nature using differential equations? And he says, no, you know, it's more a better tool for understanding nature would be computer programming. In other words, nature, in that this tree has a set of rules, and these rules are repeated and modified to build the tree. So, and then he says, really great quote, you're going to hear it from me again. He says, I think when I find the code that generates our world, it'll be about 6 lines. In other words, 6 lines of computer type code can make our entire world. Pretty radical idea, but those are the kind of people we're going to talk about in this show. Very famously, Ray Kurzweil. If you don't, I strongly recommend kurzweil.net. So KURZWEIL, and then AI for artificial intelligence, and then .net. He has news stories up every day. You can subscribe to his newsletter, and it'll come in your email every day. And there'll be about 3 to 5 stories, two or three sentences each. And then you can click on the ones you want to follow through on. Things like, totally new form of solar energy that's 10 times more efficient, or, you know, solar panel, or the ability to manipulate a single atom to do quantum computing. This incredible stuff that's going on in technology that's just starting to break into the world. I mean, just think about it. I'm not going to tell you how old I am. You can figure it out. But talking about how old I am, I want to say hello to everybody out there. And if there's anybody who, 25 years ago, when occasionally Gary Null would invite me to guest host on his show when he was out of town. So anybody who remembers me from back then, hi, how are you? And, but anyway, if we, over time, we just see this stuff happening, like our smartphones. And, we're looking at now, we'll see if it really pans out. But they're now saying 5 to 6 years for self-driving cars. They exist now. In 5 or 6 years, they'll be totally reliable and ubiquitous. And what does that mean? And of course, it means, if we think it through, we'll probably have 1/4 as many cars because 90% of people will give up their cars. Why own a car when a car, you know, zip, tap your smartphone and 5 minutes later, there's a car standing in front of you and you don't have to deal with the driver because it's a self-driving car. But there's a computer scientist named Sebastian Thrun, and he's given us three things. So he's the one, the person at Google who was in charge of Google Glass. This was eyeglasses that would record the world and interact with it. And Google didn't pursue that, but that was just the first iteration. It's going to happen. And the idea that I keep telling you, if I say something like Ray Kurzweil, right now you can go on your phone, iPad, computer, and look him up while you're listening to me. Well, that's kind of antiquated. I mean, you know, Apple just did away with its connected earphones. You plug the earphones in, you know, and just leave them there all day. It Bluetooths from your iPhone 7. Now imagine you add glasses to that and you just blink your eye and there's Wikipedia's article on Ray Kurzweil in your eyeglasses. Don't bump into anybody while you're reading it. So anyway, Sebastian Thrun developed those, and then he launched one of the first MOOCs, and we'll talk about that as we go forward on this show, Massive Open Online Course. And that's, you know, everything at MIT, every one of their courses, all the course material, it's all online for free for anybody in the world. I mean, is this, I haven't even learned how to use it yet, although I teach MOOCs. So if you're interested in Frank Lloyd Wright, I'm a little bit of a Frank Lloyd Wright expert, you can go to buildacademy.com and you'll find my Frank Lloyd Wright course. And it's open all the time. So sometimes the MOOC, you know, has a beginning and we interact with the students and there's homework. But just to see the lectures, you can go to Build Academy and see my MOOC. Well, Sebastian Thrun teaches artificial intelligence at Stanford. And he said, you know, I can get, I don't know the numbers, you know, 150 students in this auditorium. And Stanford has 18,000 students. That's it. You know, there isn't room for the 18,001. He says, what if I put my course on the internet? 160,000 people signed up to take, you know, one of the premier artificial intelligence courses. So now many universities have many MOOC courses. Sebastian Thrun pioneered that. But the other thing he did was, so DARPA, defense, whatever, anyway, research arm of the Pentagon, was trying to get self-driving cars. And they go, you know, across the desert so they can't crash into anything important. And they wouldn't get very far. You know, they get like a mile and a half and they end up in a ditch. And all these people were competing with their self-driving cars. Sebastian Thrun got a bunch of, you know, a handful of Stanford students together and made a self-driving car and it did the thing. Well, it's here. You know, Google, Tesla, and Uber are in a race for owning self-driving car technology. They're all, you know, working toward this. And so these things are changing our world. And I'm several places you can go to keep up on this. I recommend KurzweilAI.com. The other one is Peter Diamandis. And I'll just briefly describe him. Peter's kind of a hyperactive guy of Greek descent who wanted to be an astronaut, but he was too short or something like that. But he became a medical doctor. He never practiced. He just went to med school, you know, as something to do. He's one of these hyperactive, super intelligent people. Well, he read a Charles Lindbergh's autobiography, The Spirit of St. Louis, and how he did the first successful solo transatlantic flight. And we all know, you know, about that, but he didn't realize the story. And the story is that someone had put up, I think it was $25,000 prize for the first person to do this. And they were, you know, people were competing. And so Lindbergh was doing this to win the $25,000 prize, and he did. And then you think about it, that $25,000 initiated hundreds of thousands of dollars in research effort, expenses, developing the airplanes. So a person putting up a modest prize like that, although, you know, that was, they'll buy a house, pretty nice house in those days, would initiate all that activity. Inspired by that, Peter Diamandis launched the X Prize, and the first one was for the first people who made reusable, returnable spaceflight. In other words, that you could take off with, I don't remember the exact terms, I think two or three passengers, go into a low orbit, return, and do it again within a week, so that you would have developed doable, reasonable, repeatable spaceflight, as opposed to these monster things that NASA did. Well, somebody won it. And now they've got X prizes for all kinds of stuff, like a tricorder. Remember in Star Trek, you know, Bones waves this thing over a patient and it does all the diagnosis and okay, he's cured. What if you whether it's a gizmo or a glove, and you put it on your child's body, and it goes off, you know, speaks to a remote computer, comes back, tells you what to do, and parts of the world without access to certain kinds of medical care, this could be very life-changing, world-changing. So this is one of dozens of things that they have these X prizes for. And it, you know, a $10 million X prize can encourage $100 million of research by the people competing. Anyway, I'm digressing. That's what I'm good at. I'm very good at digressing. But let me finish up with some thoughts on visionary creativity. And let me repeat again for people just tuning in. My name is John Lobel, and our new show here, this is our first broadcast, is Visionaries on PRN, Progressive Radio Network. You know you can get it online because if you're listening right now. And usually I will have guests. I just described up and coming. I'm going to have Bob Walter, who's the president of the Joseph Campbell Foundation. We'll talk about Joseph Campbell. That's next week from today. Natasha Vita Moore, who's a transhumanist and is the chair of Humanity Plus. Phil Cousineau, storyteller. John David Ebert, cultural critic. Luis Arana, who is an artificial intelligence engineer. Mike Silver, architectural researcher. And we'll go on from there. Send me an email, johnlobel@mac.com, for the kind of guests you'd like to see. And this idea of visionary creativity, again, I don't accept our world as a given. You know, scientific materialism holds that there is a material world and we occupy it, and our consciousness of it is a function of the material firing of neurons under the laws of physics. I don't think that's adequate. I think that there are very different worlds out there. Earlier in the show, I went through some, in case you didn't catch it, a little questionnaire I give my students just to sort of open things up for our our when we talk about non-Western architecture, looking at the world, and we were created by a creator, or the world is made, which is fundamentalist biblical traditions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. The world is made up of matter, energy, and the laws of nature, materialism. The world has always been and will not end, and our consciousness participates in it, Buddhism. Human beings are natural creatures and are integral with spirit, human, and nature, and that's Taoism. Human beings are the central, most important thing and source of knowledge. That's humanism. And the universe is harmonious and balanced, and humans are a disruption. That's deep ecology. So where did these worldviews come from? And I contend they come from visionary creatives, that there are people whose visions actually create the world, and the serious artists, the Michelangelos and Leonardos and Beethovens and Picassos, they hold those statures because they create these, they create the world, they recreate the world. So just to look at the back of my book, these are times of turmoil, but times of turmoil can also be times of creativity as we become aware of new possibilities in our arts, science, and industries, and of new directions in our lives. So the book is Visionary Creativity, How New Worlds Are Born, and hopefully we'll see some of those worlds being born on our show. Now, I want to end, we're running out of time here. Wow, I was worried about, you know, how do you fill an hour? and can I get another hour? but in understanding where creativity comes from, there was an article, an op-ed piece in the New York Times, January 30, 2016, How to Raise a Creative Child, Step 1, Back Off, by Adam Grant. And it begins, they learn to read by age 2, play Bach at 4, breeze through calculus at 6, and speak foreign languages fluently by the age of 8. Their classmates shudder with envy. Their parents rejoice at winning the lottery. But to paraphrase T.S. Eliot, their careers tend to end not with a bang but a whimper. So what's that about? You know, about these super achievers with the helicopter parents and going to the Ivy schools and getting, you know, 4.0 averages and going to be consultant at McKinsey or top law firm. Do these people create new, exciting, world-changing things? And, yeah, some of them do. But in general, maybe not. So let me end with, how do you, you know, create a visionary creative? And I'm going to turn to Friedrich Nietzsche in Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Nietzsche refers to what he calls the three metamorphoses of the spirit, how the spirit became a camel and the camel a lion and the lion finally a child. So Nietzsche says, we begin as a camel. And a camel kneels down and says, put a load on me. That's our education. We take on the knowledge of our culture, our discipline, the literature of our culture, the literature of our discipline, and really fully master it. The camel kneels down, waiting to be well-loaded. But then, well-loaded, having mastered your culture, the arts, the sciences, your discipline, the camel then runs off into the desert. Now what? Well, here's a quote from Woodrow Wilson, who you may recall was not only president, but governor of New Jersey, and before that, president of Princeton University. And Wilson writes, it is the business of a university to impart the right thought of the world, the thought through which it has tested and established the principles which have stood through the seasons, become at length part of the immemorial wisdom of the race. Well, that's a little bit convoluted writing, but Wilson is saying it's a job of the university to teach you the great wisdom the human race has accumulated. Okay, in Nietzsche's model, that's only step one. How about to question and, if need be, to overthrow the immemorial wisdom of the race? Such questioning and overthrowing define visionary creativity, but are not there in Wilson's model. In reading books about this material, I've been following this, and maybe we'll talk more about next week, but Nietzsche says the spirit becomes a lion who would conquer his freedom and be master of his own desert. The lion runs out into the desert where he encounters a dragon whose name is Thou Shalt, and the lion fights and defeats the dragon. So the lion is able to destroy the old, but can't create the new. That is done by the child. To create new values, the lion is not capable of this. But to create the freedom to create the new, this is within the power of lion. And then the lion becomes a child. The child is innocent and forgetting, a new beginning. The child is a wheel rolling out of its own center. So here's a model of creativity. We're going to, on our show Visionaries, be interviewing the children, the people, wheels rolling out of their own center, who bring about and create the new.